This is Dr. Roger Green in his teaching on American Christianity. This is session number 9, The Emergence of American Unitarianism.
Religion in the American Revolution, and we are down to number 5. We're talking about the reaction of the churches, and some of the churches were particularly affected by the American Revolution, either like Anglicanism, because the numbers dropped considerably in America because they were pro-British, obviously, or Congregationalism, on the other hand, that was largely for the Revolution and supported the Revolution. So we talked about the Anglican Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and American Methodism. Number 5, other denominations. There are other denominations that were not affected, and I'll just mention 3 by way of example. And those were the Baptists, the Presbyterians, and the Quakers. So some denominations weren't affected one way or another, Baptists, Presbyterians, and Quakers. In 1976, as the celebration of the 200th anniversary of the Revolutionary War, in 1976, there were lots of displays and so forth. And I was very interested. I went down to Faneuil Hall to see some of those displays, and it demonstrated very clearly that for many of those denominations, especially the ones I mentioned, Baptist, Quaker, Presbyterian, they weren't really affected, but there were certainly Christians who were on either side of the story, who some were pro-revolutionary, some were pro-British, but the denominations themselves weren't so seriously affected. But, and then we come here to universalism, number 6, because we haven't talked about universalism yet, and so we'll just mention that. Yes. Celebration of the 200th anniversary of the Revolutionary War. And in Boston, for example, there were lots of displays and lots of events going on as 1976 as we celebrated that 200th anniversary. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about universalism because we haven't talked about that yet. And then we'll say a quick word about church attendance during this time. Universalism, obviously, a belief that all people are going to be saved, that all people, there is not going to be kind of a hell. Everybody's going to go to heaven. Everybody's going to be redeemed. Everybody's going to be saved. So we haven't talked about universalism yet. The founder of universalism was a man by the name of John Murray, and these are his dates. And he founded universalism in Britain, and then in 1770, he came to America, and he began to spread the universalist message in America. Universalism was a message that squared with a lot of people's kind of rational beliefs in Christianity. Christianity was a rational religion, a reasonable religion, and it certainly appeared to people that it's reasonable to believe that God's grace is going to save everybody, kind of reasonable to believe that. There were 3 kind of views of the universalists that I just want to mention because they didn't have a singular view. They had 3 kind of nuanced views, in a sense. The first was this, that Christ made full payment on the cross. So these people looked to the cross of Christ. They said he died on the cross. And he died for all people. He made full payment. And under this first point, what they're reacting against is any kind of a Calvinist understanding of the elect. They're reacting against any understanding of predestination. So that's number 1 in terms of the universalists. Christ died for everybody. So, number 2, they believe that when people die, they are going to be immediately taken into the presence of God. So nobody will come under judgment. They will believe, and their divine blessedness begins when people die. Number 3 is where the nuanced part comes in, What about a recognition that there is human freedom to say no to God? What about a recognition that there is such a thing in this world called sin? What about that? What about people who are sinners in rebellion against God in this world? How are they? How do they fit into the story? Well, the Universalists believed that after death, there would be a time of purification. It wasn't exactly the purgatory of Roman Catholicism, but there would be a period of purification, at which time then they would be prepared to, at some point in their after-death experience, some point they would be able to go and meet with God. But this time of purification is not eternal. It's not hell. It's not eternal punishment. It's more of a purging in preparation to meet God. So when you look at the Universalists, they have three kind of points that they're trying to make. 1790, so after the Revolutionary War, the Universalists held a convention. They were strong enough. I don't know actually how many were at the convention. I should look that up. But they were strong enough to hold a convention. So where did they hold that convention? In Philadelphia. Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. Everybody seemed to like to go to Philadelphia to hold their conventions, and the Universalists went there. All right, let me just, you can see in your outline, I just want to make a word about church attendance during the time of the Revolution, and then we'll move on here. Okay, church attendance at the time of the Revolution. There are two extremes to be avoided, and the truth is probably somewhere kind of in the middle. The one extreme is what I would say the mythological extreme in terms of church attendance. The mythological extreme, to be avoided, says that everybody went to church. All these people were in church every Sunday, and they were very devout believers, and they belonged to all these different denominations, so that the whole American population was in church. Well, there's nothing that can support that. We've mentioned that many of these people were deists. They didn't have a regular church attendance and so forth. So that would be the mythological extreme to avoid in terms of church attendance. I don't think we want to go down that route. So now, the second extreme to avoid is kind of a myopic view of church attendance. And the myopic view says you can only measure church attendance by actual church membership. And in some places, church membership was rather low. But that would be a myopic view because the fact of the matter is a lot of people were attending churches who did not become members of churches. So a lot of people were going to church, but they had not joined any particular denomination. They were going to the local Congregational church or the local Anglican church or whatever. So generally speaking, what scholars have found out, generally speaking, is that church attendance is much larger than church membership. So generally speaking, that seems to be the case. If I were to give one statistic, about 1780 or so, it seems as though about 3/5 of the population attended church on a regular basis, 1780, after the American Revolutionary War, after we settled in to being a new nation. So about 3/5 of the population are attending church. It seemed to have dropped lower during the time of the Revolutionary War, but now it's starting to pick up again. And now something's going to happen later on in a later lecture called the Second Great Awakening. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that later. Okay, just to make sure we're all caught up here, let's go to lecture number 6, The Emergence of American Unitarianism. We'll give the background, and then we'll talk about Unitarianism in America, especially here in Boston. So that's lecture number 6, and the exam covers up to and including lecture number 6. That's why I wish we had been here Monday, because I could have done this lecture. And I like to finish my lectures about a week before you take the exam, so you've got plenty of time to study. But we're doing okay. So, first of all, background. Well, what is Unitarianism? Unitarianism, of course, is the a disbelief in the Trinity and a belief in the oneness of God. Unitarianism wants to emphasize monotheism, and in order to do so, they believe, the Unitarians believe, that the Trinity speaks against monotheism. Now, there were Unitarians in the early church. Didn't call themselves Unitarians, but Unitarianism in the early church was around, where people were denying the Trinity and embracing just a pure monotheism, but who called themselves Christians nevertheless. But Unitarianism that we're interested in, Unitarianism that really comes forward into American life and culture, really starts in the 16th century. And it starts with a man by the name of Michael Servetus. That's the name that you would associate with the beginning of Unitarianism during the time of the Reformation. Now, Michael Servetus was a Unitarian and argued against John Calvin, of course, who was also a monotheist, but John Calvin, of course, believed in the Trinity. So long story short about Michael Servetus. Michael Servetus came to Geneva in 1533. That's where Calvin was preaching and teaching in Geneva. Geneva had become kind of one of the great centers of the Reformation. Michael Servetus, I want to make sure we understand this, because even though it doesn't relate directly to this course, Calvin is often blamed for burning Michael Servetus at the stake. Calvin did not do that. People who say that Calvin burned this guy at the stake, they just don't know their history. Calvin tried to convince Michael Servetus not to come to Geneva. He thought that if Servetus came to Geneva, Servetus would be in trouble. So he tried to convince him not to come to Geneva. Servetus wanted to come to Geneva. He wanted to debate with Calvin. Servetus was arrested by the authorities, not by the civil authorities, not by Calvin, and then Servetus was burned at the stake. Now, we've got to take our mind back to the 16th century, 17th century. Why were people burned at the stake? In that time, to preserve the common good, to preserve society, the social order. And heretics are a threat to the social order. So Michael Servetus was burned at the stake for that reason, not by Calvin, but by the civil authorities. So we do want to mention Servetus. The man who interests us most, however, there's a couple names, but one is John Biddle. Because John Biddle, here are the dates of John Biddle. John Biddle began to organize what he called Unitarian thinking in England. Yes, okay. Yep. Yes. Calvin, long story short, but Calvin had been at Geneva, and then they kind of ran him out of town. But then when they saw how his theology, his preaching, had such a good influence upon the culture and upon the world of Geneva, they invited him back. So he became a person who helped Geneva, in a sense, to set forth a moral, cultural tone in Geneva. It wasn't a theocracy. He was not a civil servant of any kind. He was a preacher, had his church, but he influenced Genevan life greatly. It became a Protestant Reformed city. And other people, in fact, he set up the Geneva Academy so that people from around Europe could come and study at the Geneva Academy and take his thinking and his thoughts back to their own countries and so forth. So Geneva is a model kind of Reformed city. And the civil authorities were grateful to Calvin for the influence that he had upon civic life in terms of the morality and so forth. Yeah. Does that help a bit?
Yeah. And this is just another example. Do you know how long that lasted?
How long Geneva lasted as a Well, it still has a strong Protestant heritage today, I would say. Certainly lasted. I mean, some of the Puritans found refuge in Geneva because it was such a strong Protestant Calvinist city. They were Calvinists. Yeah, Emery?
Oh, sorry. I was just going to clarify. So
yeah.
He didn't burn them at the stake.
Right.
He was trying to save them.
he warned Servetus not to come because he knew what the civil authorities would do to Servetus if he came to Geneva. Servetus came. Calvin even visited him when he was imprisoned. He went to visit him in prison. And he really thought, he wanted Servetus to see God in his fullness, in his Trinitarian fullness. So he tried to have that ministry with Servetus, but it didn't work. Civil authorities burned him at the stake. Yeah. Okay, John Biddle. John Biddle is the one who's interesting to us because he's the one who shaped Unitarianism in England. Now, Unitarianism in the 17th century fit very well in an English rationalistic society. So Unitarianism and rationalism really go together really beautifully because Unitarians explained the Christian faith in a very rationalistic way. Okay. Now, what happened in England is it began to grow. It really began to take on some strength in England for two reasons under Biddle. Okay? Reason number one, well, not both under Biddle, but he got it started. But reason number one is that under Biddle, it became kind of a missionary endeavor. The Unitarians tried to be missionaries throughout England to convince people that they should be Unitarians. And actually, they convinced a lot of Baptists and Presbyterians who moved into Unitarianism. So under Biddle, the kind of the missionary missionary impulse, I guess, helped to spread Unitarianism in England. Okay, second reason it grew in England is after Biddle's day, but it leads us to another name, and his name is Dr. Joseph Priestley. Okay, now, why do you know the name Joseph Priestley? Why is that name familiar to you? Because he was such a well-known scientist in England at the time. He was a very well-known person, Dr. Joseph Priestley. So there he is. As one author said, he's a chemist, a thinker, a reasonable person, and Joseph Priestley, even though he was reared in Anglicanism, Joseph Priestley became a Unitarian. So this man, who was of great stature in England, becomes Unitarian, and he even became a Unitarian minister, and that really forwarded the cause of Unitarianism. And that kind of English background to Unitarianism is certainly going to come over to America. It was finally recognized, by the way, in 1813 in England. It was recognized as a legitimate denominational religion, 1813. So Unitarianism takes on that shape through Biddle and then through Priestley. Okay, now, still in terms of background, there is a shift in Unitarian thinking from Biddle's day to Priestley's day and on. So let me talk about that shift, because if we don't understand that shift, we're going to get the wrong impression of Unitarianism in terms of its history. Early Unitarians, and Priestley's a good example of that even, so he comes quite a bit after Biddle, as you can see, but early Unitarians were very focused on the Bible. The Bible was very important to them. And they read a lot from the Scripture, they preached a lot from the Scripture, they sang from the Scripture. Because the Scriptures accented, for them, the Scriptures accented this one God who was a God of love. Now, of course, they had difficulties with the biblical text, and especially difficulties with the incarnation, and then the miracles of Jesus, and his death on a cross, and his resurrection, his ascension. They had difficulties with the biblical text. But they still tried to wrestle through the biblical text. They kept on trying to work with the Bible. But yet they were firm about their Unitarian convictions as well. Okay, now, as other generations started to come into Unitarianism, the Bible was used less and less. Finally, a lot of Unitarians decided, we don't need the Bible anymore. Everything we believe can be understood by reason, by the use of our rational abilities, by the use of our reason, so the Bible is out. And so Unitarianism for a while became kind of split between this old wing, this more conservative wing, these biblical Unitarians, and the new wing, these more liberal people, these rational Unitarians. So for a while, Unitarianism became kind of split. But eventually, the biblical wing dies out. So eventually, the biblical wing is gone. And Unitarianism becomes, in England, strictly kind of a rational religion. Now, what happens, of course, for our interest, what happens, of course, is that it starts to come over into America. So that's Unitarianism in America, that's number B. Okay. The first person that's of interest to us in America is a man by the name of James Freeman. And there are the dates of James Freeman, 1759 to 1835. Okay, long story short on James Freeman. James Freeman had a church called, I should have put these in order, but oh yeah, here it is. Well, James Freeman had a church in Boston called King's Chapel. So he's the pastor of King's Chapel. You're going to recognize King's Chapel, right? Because all of you have been on, is there anyone who hasn't been on the Freedom Trail? By any chance, is there anyone in this room? You can confess this, it's okay, even though you've been a Gordon 2, 3, 4 years. Have you been on the Freedom Trail in Boston? You have to, okay. No, okay. Well, we're going to walk certain sections of the Freedom Trail. So confession is good for the soul. So we're going to walk certain, if you're going on the field trips, we'll be walking on certain sections of the Freedom Trail. This is dominant on the Freedom Trail. If you've walked the Freedom Trail, you've passed by this church. This is dominant. This is King's Chapel. James Freeman was the Anglican priest at King's Chapel. In 1785, that's an important date. You want to take note of that date. In 1785, this became the first Unitarian church in America under James Freeman, under their pastor, under their priest. So here you have an Anglican church that, as a congregation under the direction of Freeman, moves over into Anglicanism. And so that's where it all starts, right here in Boston. That's where it all is. So, no, went into Unitarian. It was an Anglican church, and it became Unitarian Church, and it became the first Unitarian Church in America. Yeah. Now, the second person to mention in terms of American Christianity is probably the most important when it comes to the kind of shaping of Unitarianism, and his name is William Ellery Channing. And this is a picture of the young William Ellery Channing. Okay, William Ellery Channing. And here, he had a church, and the church was called the Federal Street Congregational Church, also in Boston. So the Federal Street Congregational Church. Now today, it's called the Arlington Street Congregational Church, and here it is. But this is the Federal Street Congregational Church when William Ellery Channing was the pastor, the rector. We'll walk by. This is now Federal Street's now called Arlington Street, so it's now called the Arlington Street Congregational Church. But today it's a Unitarian church because William Ellery Channing took that church, which was originally Congregational, and moved it into Unitarianism. Right across the street from the church is this statue of William Ellery Channing. So we will stop and see on one of our field trips, not the first one, but the second one, we'll walk by the church, but we'll also see the statue of William Ellery Channing. So let's give a title for Channing. William Ellery Channing is the father of American Unitarianism. He is the one who shaped American Unitarianism, starting at his church. Okay? So, with William Ellery Channing, there are three dates that are important. The first one is 1815, because 1815 is when he, let me put a picture back of his church, 1815 is when he led his church into becoming a Unitarian church. So that's an important date in Channing's life, in terms of his ministry, in terms of his really becoming a leader in shaping American Unitarianism in the way that James Freeman didn't. James Freeman predates William Ellery Channing. Okay. Second date is 1816. 1816. Very important date. Because in 1816, Harvard University founded a divinity school in 1816. And it was basically a Unitarian divinity school. And William Ellery Channing would have preached there. He would have taught there and so forth. So he would have had association with Harvard University's Unitarian Divinity School. Now, while we're talking about Harvard, just to fast forward on the history of Harvard for just a minute, Harvard, the university, began as a place to train Puritan preachers, remember? And do you remember that date? 1636. John Harvard gave his library to begin Harvard University. Now we get to the date 1816, and that's the founding of the Divinity School at Harvard, but as a Unitarian Divinity School. Harvard Divinity School is a very interesting place. Now I'm going to say a third thing about Harvard, and then we'll come back to the third date for William Ellery Channing. But Harvard Divinity School is a very interesting place. All kinds of people go there. I've been to Harvard Divinity School graduations, and it is such a fascinating place because one student will come up and that student will be Unitarian, and another student will come up and that student will be Jewish, and another student will come up and that student will be Native American with maybe a Native American kind of religious identity. Another student will come up and might be Buddhist. Another student might be a Taoist. But they're all getting degrees from Harvard Divinity School, which is interesting. But the fact of the matter is a lot of evangelicals have gone to Harvard Divinity School. There are probably, we've had students go to Harvard Divinity School. There are probably evangelicals at Harvard Divinity School today. So a lot of evangelicals have gone to Harvard. Now, so here's this very kind of liberal Unitarian seminary founded in 1816. All kinds of people go there to get degrees, but yet evangelicals go there. So a few years ago, there was an interesting debate. This was about 10 years ago or so. Actually, I've got the article, so I can actually see the date. This was, let's see, maybe it's longer than I thought. Yeah, it is long. It's 1983. Okay, well, life goes pretty fast. But so 1983. So there was a discussion at Harvard University and Harvard Divinity School, and the discussion was, because we've got so many evangelicals going to Harvard Divinity School, should we have an evangelical chair at Harvard Divinity School? Should we have someone come here to teach evangelical, Christian, Protestant, evangelical theology? And the answer was, yes, we need an evangelical chair at Harvard Divinity School. And the first person to fill the chair at Harvard Divinity School was a man by the name of Mark Knoll. Now, you may be familiar with his name from other readings and so forth. He was at that time at Wheaton College. He is now at Notre Dame. But a very distinguished church historian, an American church historian. And Mark Knoll went to be the first chair of the evangelical chair at Harvard Divinity School. I was able to go to that, to his inaugural address and to all the celebrations of this evangelical chair. So it's kind of interesting that, in a sense, by establishing an evangelical chair, Harvard Divinity School was going back to the roots of the university, back to the Puritan roots, in a sense. So it's very interesting that that all happened. And there's been many people. George Marsden is another very well-known American historian, and a historian of fundamentalism and evangelicalism. He has been in that chair. So it's been an interesting history. So anyways, that's Harvard Divinity School founded. Pardon? No. There's a man now who is a Methodist from Boston University. I believe his name is David Hempton, I think. I'd have to check on that to be sure, just to be sure. But I think it's a chair that is a one-year chair. So the person who goes there is there for a year, teaches evangelical theology and so forth, and then it changes every year. But the people who have had the chair are very notable scholars, no doubt about that. Yeah.
Do the Unitarians still deny the Bible then?
Yes, that Unitarians basically, you could probably go into a Unitarian church and find a preacher maybe, and we're going to talk about this in just a minute, but probably you would find a preacher maybe who might be using certain scriptures, maybe the Lord's Prayer, maybe some of the Beatitudes and so forth. But the evangelical chair at Harvard Divinity School, that person can teach evangelical theology. That's what they got him there to do. So they got him there to teach evangelical theology and the authority of the Bible and all kinds of things. Yeah, so we're rejoicing in this. So. No, it's no longer, no. It was founded as a Unitarian institution in 1816. Now Harvard Divinity School, I'd have to look at their, you know, mission statement or whatever just to check on that today. But they welcome all who want to come and study at Harvard Divinity School. You do not have to be Unitarian. The professors don't have to be Unitarian to teach at Harvard Divinity School. So, yeah. We're going to get to that in just a minute. Why don't I hold to that, and we're going to come to that. Let me give the third date for William Ellery Channing. Remember we said we had three dates for him? We had the date when his church became Unitarian, 1815. We had the founding of Harvard Divinity School, 1816. The third date is really, really an important date, because the third date is when William Ellery Channing founded the American Unitarian Association. And the American Unitarian Association was an association of Unitarian churches finding common ground together, kind of discussing their theology and so forth. So that was founded in 1825. And William Ellery Channing was the founder. Actually, when we're up on Beacon Hill, there's a little plaque. It's a little hard to see, so I have to, you know, people walk by it every day and don't notice it, but there's a little plaque that tells you the home in which William Ellery Channing lived while he was pastoring this church in Boston, right up in Beacon Hill. So we'll pass by that. So the American Unitarian Association, founded in 1825. So those three dates really are important. Okay, now we're still on Unitarianism in America. So let me just go back to another name here, and that is the name of Ralph Waldo Emerson and a movement called Transcendentalism. Okay, so the question is, what is Transcendentalism? Transcendentalism was a movement out of Unitarianism. In other words, the Transcendentalists basically had been Unitarians. That had been their their church, their denomination. They had been reared in that kind of tradition. But with Ralph Waldo Emerson, he's the most famous transcendentalist, both kind of theologically and in terms of literature. So I mentioned Ralph Waldo Emerson here. You're familiar with him from other courses and that. But with Ralph Waldo Emerson, we have this movement called Transcendentalism. Now, there's 5 points I want to make about Transcendentalism here. First of all, the Transcendentalism was really a rejection of Unitarian rationalism. Unitarianism had become very rational, very reasonable. It's kind of defending their cause by reason, you know. And there were people who were reared in Unitarianism who were kind of fed up with that kind of very strict rationalism of Unitarianism. So secondly then, Transcendentalism, instead of embracing the Enlightenment movement, which was a movement of reasonableness and rational, they embraced the Romantic movement. So Transcendentalism is an embracing of Romanticism. And you know that culturally, that's the kind of the movement that followed the age of the Enlightenment in the 19th century. So they're embracing that. Thirdly, the Transcendentalists emphasize religious truth by intuition. Religious truth can come to you by your intuition, can come to you by your experience. You don't need to prove religious truth by some kind of rational proofs. And you don't need to find those religious truths in a book called the Bible. As a matter of fact, for many transcendentalists, you don't even need to find that religious truth in something called the church. You can find that religious truth by your intuitive feelings, by your intuitive kind of inner knowledge. That religious truth can come to you. Number 4, of course, they believe that God is in every person's heart. I don't know exactly what that means, but God is in every person's heart. You know, God is kind of around us, kind of, that's kind of the oversoul of transcendentalism. God is in every person's heart. So there's kind of this heart religion. It doesn't need to be organized. You don't need a book. You don't need a Bible. You don't need a church. You don't need a building. It's in everybody's kind of heart. And also, number five that you see up here, God dwells in nature as well. These people were, the transcendentalists were also almost pantheistic in some ways, that God is contained in the natural world. So you, there's where you can find God, in the natural world. So, transcendentalism is a break-off from Unitarianism in a sense. Now, some of these transcendentalists still attended Unitarian churches, so this isn't a total break. But transcendentalism is a movement out of Unitarianism emphasizing these kinds of things. And Ralph Waldo Emerson's best expression of that. So. Okay, now the question is, what do Unitarians believe? That's what we want to kind of figure out. Unfortunately, you can identify Unitarians more by what they don't believe than what they do believe. But anyways, what do they believe? Oh, I meant to mention, before I do that, what do they believe? Before I do that, let me just show you one more picture here. The Unitarians united with the Universalists in 1961. So the Unitarians and the Universalists came together in 1961 and formed the denomination called the Unitarian Universalist denomination. So Unitarian churches that you see, you know, in the center of these New England villages, those are Unitarian-Universalist churches. And the headquarters is right up in Boston, the international headquarters. There it is. There's their flag, the blue flag. And on the right, you see the State House. So you can kind of see where you are here and where we're going to walk by that headquarters and point it out when we get there. But so, yeah.
What was that year?
1961. Yeah. Okay, I meant to mention that. Okay, now, what do the Unitarians believe? That's the question. And you need a 10-second break. No, 5-second break. It's only Wednesday. 5 seconds. That's all you get on Wednesday. It's 5 seconds. Bless your heart. This movement that was kind of founded by these people, what do they believe? Okay, I'm going to mention about 8 things that they believe. Unfortunately, some of them are negative. So it's what they're reacting against that defined Unitarianism. Okay, let's start off with a positive, one positive thing. The Unitarians believed in loving your neighbor. They believed in charitable work. So that's a good thing. So we'll start off positively. They did believe in charity. They did believe in loving your neighbor and so forth. So. Yes, we're still under B, Unitarianism in America. So now this is just some, what do they believe? What do they hold? Yeah. So, first of all, they believed in charitable work. They believed in loving your neighbor. I think that would be pretty distinctive. If you went into a unit, I was just walking in Andover a couple of days ago, and I walked by the Unitarian Universalist Church, and very much by the signage of the church and everything, very much involved in kind of charitable work and changing society for the better, that kind of thing. So that's number one. Number two, of course, it is a denial of the Trinity. This is where they really make a break with historic Christianity. They deny the Trinity. This is a denial of the Trinity. Okay. Number three, which follows from number two, it's a denial of atonement. It's a denial of the doctrine of atonement. You do not need an atonement if that atonement is going to be universal. If when everybody dies, you're going to go and be with God, you don't need some atonement to happen here in this world. So it's a denial of the atonement, especially, of course, of the atonement as espoused by the death of Christ on the cross. Right. They believe that Jesus is a good person, a moral person, an ethical person. They believe he actually lived. He's kind of like the prophets. So they believe he actually lived. The Spirit, they're glad to talk about the Spirit, but that's not a third person of the Trinity for them. The Spirit is just God's Spirit at work in the natural world, or God at work in our souls, in our bodies, and so forth. So that's for them. That's the Spirit. Now, what did if you take this second person of the Trinity? We all know this, don't we, from mere Christianity. Jesus is a good man. He's a moral man. He's a nice man. You should be like Jesus. What did C.S. Lewis say about that in Mere Christianity? He's either lunatic or Lord. Lewis said, you can never take this middle ground on Jesus. It's impossible. Because he's either who he said he is, he's Lord, or he is a lunatic because he's a man who kept on saying he was God, you know, and doing things that God did and everything. So he's Lord or lunatic. So C.S. Lewis wouldn't let people take that middle ground. But the Unitarian Universalists have basically taken that ground and stand on Jesus. Good moral man, good prophet. We should learn some things from him. Yeah. Okay, so it's a denial of the atonement. Yeah, Alexander? Yes, Unitarians. I'd have to look and see how many countries where they operate, but there are still Unitarian churches in England. I've passed by Unitarian churches in England. Yeah, and wouldn't you know, it would be Boston that would be the bastion of Unitarianism in our backyard right here. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So you said that they believe everyone goes to heaven.
Yes.
Yes,
that's a good question, because even though the merger didn't come until 1961, you know, our time, 20th century, Unitarians were already basically Universalists as well. So it was a pretty natural that they would come together, and they finally did. It took them a while, but they finally did. Yep. Yeah. For the what?
Freeman.
Yeah, let me go back to Freeman and get him. Yeah, here, whoops, there he is right there. Yeah, Freeman is 1759, 1835. Okay, fourth, Unitarians believed, or denied, I should say, the doctrine of original sin. They denied the doctrine of original sin. There is no original sin. People make mistakes. There might be some people who sin, even. It's a possibility. But original sin as an inherited disease passed down from Adam, no way, you know. So they denied the doctrine of original sin. So, yeah, Aaron? Yeah, okay. James Freeman? Okay. Right. Yes, right. He was the Anglican priest of King's Chapel. And in 1885... They stayed in the chapel, but in 1885 they joined Unitarianism as a congregation with him as their priest, their minister. So that's why he's so important, because this is the first church in America ever to become Unitarian, King's Chapel. Yeah, does that help? I'm Freeman. Okay, so no original sin. Sin is out for these people, in a sense. Okay, another thing we should take note of, number five, they denied the doctrine of predestination. They fought against the Puritan Calvinist understanding of election, predestination, double election. They denied all of that. So they really are in combat with the Calvinists, no doubt about that, for a lot of reasons, but for this reason as well. Okay, number six, they developed, maybe not totally consciously, but they developed kind of a salvation by good morals, a salvation by ethics, a salvation by being a good person, that's how you place yourself in a good relationship with God. So it became kind of a salvation by character in a way, so salvation by works. So maybe they didn't quite intend it to be following the Roman Catholics and a salvation by works, but that's the way it went. Yeah. Yes, ultimately everyone is still saved. Now, if you, to the Unitarian preacher in Boston, to William Ellery Channing, there he is preaching in his church, if he sees an absolute reprobate out there, you know, somebody who's a real sinner and angry against God and so forth, well, he'll preach to him, but he'll know that if he if he's not saved in this life, then in the afterlife, he'll come through a time of purging, but eventually he'll go and be with God. So they're convinced that this is going to happen. So yeah. Yes, and a good example of that is Harvard Divinity School. They go to Harvard Divinity School. They get a Master of Divinity degree. They become ordained into the Unitarian Universalist ministry.
Yeah.
They are ministers. They are ordained ministers. Now, one thing that Unitarianism has done, though, I will say, Unitarianism has recognizes and is honest about the fact that they are not Orthodox Christians. They do not align with the Orthodox Christian faith. So I think they're careful not to call themselves Christian, not in the Orthodox sense anyways. Yeah. Okay, still a couple more things that they did believe or didn't believe or do believe or don't believe. Okay, the next to the last is something we've already mentioned. They have a very low view of the Bible, if any view of the Bible at all. It certainly is a low view, if any view. So, therefore, the word I'll use is that the Bible is not an authority, a source of authority for Unitarian Universalism. If you've got Unitarians who read the Bible or sections of the Bible, if you've got Unitarian preachers who might preach from the Beatitudes or might preach from loving God and so forth, that's fine. But that Unitarian preacher would never say the Bible is God's authority for truth. So they would never say that. But, yeah. Right. Well, doctrine's not quite a word. When we think of, Okay, so what they would, that'll lead me to my last point. So why don't I make that point, and then we'll see how they go here. They have had and do have a high view of reason, a high view of rationality, a high view of us being able to use our reason to determine what truth is. Now, I confess, here I'm lecturing on Unitarianism, but I confess I've never actually been to a Unitarian service. So, and kind of taken a look at, heard the preacher and so forth. I should do that sometime. I just would be interested in that. But my suspicion is that in the Unitarian service, what the preacher is going to be relying on is a reasoned argument about being good to your neighbor, or a reasoned argument about being a good moral person because it's good for the common good. So that's my suspicion. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. So, okay, so that's Unitarianism. American Unitarianism. So first of all, background, and then secondly, now coming to America. So let me stop for a couple minutes. Questions about what we're most interested in is getting this thing over to American Christianity. So any question about Freeman or William Ellery Channing, very important, a very important person in American Christianity shaping this thing, or about Unitarianism just in general, about what they believe. Any questions here? Okay, so the exam, this is where the exam stops. The first hour exam stops here. So you've got lectures 1 through 6. So we're doing okay. That gives you a few days to kind of get ready for the exam from your lectures. Yeah. Whoops. Yes. Ralph Waldo Emerson and a few intellectuals in Lexington and Concord. He was I mentioned his name because you'd be familiar with his name in terms of literature and so forth. But a few people founded this movement called Transcendentalism. And it was a very elite intellectual movement. I mean, these people were poets and writers and thinkers and so forth. So it wasn't a movement for the whosoever, for sure. So it was a very powerful intellectual movement. The reason, now Transcendentalism has a real influence on American broader culture, not necessarily Christian culture, but broader culture, because these people were literary geniuses and literary people that people were reading, So that's how it had an influence on the broader culture. Yeah. something else here. On you understand where we are here for you understand where we are for the exam. Okay, bless your hearts. I don't think I'll start the second Great Awakening today with 5 minutes to go. I'm going to give you 5 minutes, get another cup of coffee, and questions on Friday, and bring the books on Friday, and we will help you get ready for the exam again.
This is Dr. Roger Green in his teaching on American Christianity. This is session number 9, The Emergence of American Unitarianism.